his arm, and I could smell warm, scented water. He was already faultlessly dressed in garb that was even more elegantly understated than what he had worn yesterday. His colours today were cream and forest green, with a thin edging of gilt at his cuffs and collar. He wore a new earring, a filigreed golden orb. I knew what was inside it. He looked fresh and alert. I sat up and then cradled my aching head in my hands. "Skill headache?" he asked, sympathetically. I shook my head and the pain rattled inside it. "I only wish it were," I muttered. I glanced up at him. "I'm just tired."
"I thought perhaps you would sleep in the tower."
"It didn't feel right." I rose and tried to stretch, but my back kinked in protest. The fool set the clothing across the foot of the bed and then sat down on my rumpled blankets.
"So, any thoughts on where our prince might be?"
"Too many. Anywhere in Buck Duchy or even beyond the borders by now. There are too many nobles who might want to take him. If he ran on his own, that only increases the number of places he might have gone." The wash water was still steaming. A few leaves of lemon balm floated fragrantly on the surface of the plain pottery bowl. I plunged my face into it gratefully and came up rubbing my hands over my face. I felt more awake and aware of the world. "I need a bath. Are the steam baths behind the guards' barracks still there?"
"Yes, but servants don't use them. You'll have to be wary of falling back into old habits. Personal servants, generally speaking, get the second use of their master's or mistress's bathwater. Or they haul their own from the kitchens."
I gave him a look. "I'll haul my own tonight." I proceeded to make the best use I could of the hand basin while he sat and silently watched me. While I was shaving, he observed quietly,
"You'll have to get up earlier tomorrow. All the kitchen staff know that I'm an early riser."
I looked at him in consternation.
"And?" "And they'll be expecting my servant to come down for my breakfast tray."
The sense sank in slowly. He was right. I needed to do a better job of stepping into my role if I was to find out anything useful.
"I'll go now," I offered.
He shook his head.
"Not looking like that. Lord Golden is a proud and temperamental man. He would not keep such a rough-thatched servant as you show yourself now. We must make you look your part. Come here and sit down."
I followed him out into the light and air of the master chamber. He had set out comb, brush, and shears on his table and propped a large mirror on it. I steeled myself to endure this. I crossed to the door to be sure it was securely bolted against untimely intrusion. Then I sat in a chair and waited for him to lop my hair into a servant's short cut. I freed my hair from its tail as Lord Golden took up the shears. When I looked into his ornately framed mirror, I saw a man I scarcely recognized. There is something about a large glass and seeing oneself all at once. Starling was right, I decided. I did look much older than my years. When I leaned back from the mirror and regarded my face, I was surprised to see how my scar had faded. It was still there, as a seam, but it was not as remarkable as it had been on a young man's unlined face. The fool let me look at myself for a time in silence. Then he gathered my hair into his hands. I glanced up at his face in the mirror. His lower lip was caught in his teeth in an agony of indecision. Abruptly, he clacked the shears back onto the table.
"No," he said emphatically. "I can't bring myself to do it, and I don't think we need to."
He took a breath, then rapidly curried my hair back into its warrior tail.
"Try the clothing," he urged me. "I had to guess its size, but no one expects a servant's clothing to be well tailored."
I went back to the small chamber and looked at the garments draped across the foot of my cot. They were cut from the familiar blue homespun that servants at Buckkeep had always worn. It was not all that different from the clothing I had worn as a child, but as I put it on, it felt different. I was donning the garments that marked me to all eyes as a serving man. A disguise, I told myself. I was not truly anyone's servant. But with a sudden pang, I wondered how Molly had felt the first time she had donned the blue dress of a serving girl. Bastard or not, I was the son of a prince. I had never expected to wear the garments of a servant. In place of my farseer charging buck, there was an embroidery of Lord Golden's golden cock pheasant. Yet the garments fitted me well, and,
Actually, these are the best quality clothes I've worn in years, I admitted, ruefully. The fool leaned round the door to look at me, and for a second I thought I saw anxiety in his eyes. But at the sight of me, he grinned, then made a show of walking a slow circle of inspection around me.
You'll do, Tom Badgerlock.
There are boots by the door, made a good 3 finger widths longer than my foot and wider, too. Best you put your things away in the chest, so that if anyone does become curious to look around our rooms, there'll be nothing to arouse suspicion. This I did hastily, while the fool quickly tidied his own chamber. Verity's sword went under the clothing in my chest. There were scarcely enough garments to cover it. The boots fitted as well as new boots usually did. Time would make them comfortable. I'm sure you remember the way to the kitchens. I always eat my breakfast on a tray in my room. The kitchen boys will be glad to see you're taking on the task of bringing it to me. It may give you an opening for gossip. He paused. Tell them I ate little last night and hence am ravenous this morning. Then bring up enough for both of us. It was strange to have him direct me so minutely, but, I reminded myself, I had best get used to it. So I bobbed a bow at him and essayed a, yes, sir, before I went out of the door of the chamber. He started to smile, caught himself and inclined a slow nod to me. Outside the chamber the castle was well awake. Other servants were busy replenishing candles and sweeping soiled rushes away, or scurrying about with fresh linens or buckets of wash water. Perhaps it was my new perspective, but it seemed to me that there were far more servants in Buckkeep than I recalled. It was not the only aspect that had changed. Queen Katrickan's mountain ways were in more evidence than ever. In her years of residence, the inside of the castle had been raised to a new standard of cleanliness. A sparse simplicity characterized the rooms I passed, replacing decades of ornate clutter that had once filled them. The tapestries and banners that remained were clean and free of cobwebs. But in the kitchens, Cook Sarah still reigned. I stepped into the steam and smells, and it was like stepping through a doorway back into my boyhood. As Chade had told me, the old cook was ensconced on a chair rather than bustling from hearth to table to hearth, but clearly food was cooked in Buckkeep kitchens as it had always been cooked. I wrenched my eyes from Sarah's ample form, lest she catch my gaze and somehow know me. I tugged humbly at the sleeve of a serving boy to make Lord Golden's breakfast wishes known to him. The boy pointed out the trays, dishes, and cutlery, and then gestured wide at the cooking hearths.
"You're his servant, not me,"
he pointed out snippily, and went back to chopping turnips. I scowled at him, but was inwardly grateful. I had soon served up enough for 2 very ample breakfasts onto the tray. I whisked it and myself out of the kitchen. I was halfway up the stair when I heard a familiar voice in conversation. I halted, and then leaned on the balustrade to look down. Unbidden, a smile came to my face. Queen Katrickan strode through the hall below, 6 ladies struggling valiantly to keep pace with her. I knew none of her ladies. They were all young, none much past 20. They had been children when last I was at Buckkeep. One looked vaguely familiar, but perhaps I had known her mother. My gaze fixed on the queen. Katrickan's shining hair, still gloriously golden, was looped and pinned about her head in a crown of braids. She wore a simple circlet of silver upon her head. She was dressed in russet brown, with an embroidered yellow kirtle, and her skirts rustled as she walked. Her ladies emulated her simple style without being able to capture it, for it was Katrickan's innate grace that lent elegance to her unpretentious garb. Despite the years that had passed, her posture and stride were still upright and unfettered. She walked with purpose, but I saw a stillness captured in her face. Some part of her was constantly aware of her missing son, and yet she still moved through the court as a queen. My heart stood still at the sight of her. I thought how proud Verity would be of this woman, and, oh, my queen, I breathed to myself. She halted in mid-stride, and I almost heard the intake of her breath. She glanced about and then up, her eyes meeting mine across the distance. In the shadow of the great hall, I could not see her blue gaze, but somehow I felt it. For an instant our eyes locked, but her face held puzzlement, not recognition. I felt the sudden thwack of fingers against the side of my head. I turned to my attacker, too amazed to be angry. A gentleman of the court, taller than I, looked down on me in sharp disapproval. His words were clipped.
You are obviously new to Buckkeep, Oaf. Here, the servants are not permitted to stare so brazenly at the Queen. Be about your business. After this, remember your place, or soon you will have no place to remember. I looked down at the tray of food I gripped, struggling to control my face. Anger drenched me. I knew that my face had darkened with blood. It took every bit of my will to avert my eyes and bob my head. Your pardon, sir, I will remember. I hoped he took my strangled voice for crushed humiliation rather than rage. Gripping the sides of the tray tightly, I continued my journey up the stairs as he went down, and did not allow myself to glance over the balustrade to see if my queen watched me go. A servant. A servant. I am a loyal, well-trained man-servant. I am newly come from the country, but well-recommended, so I am a mannered servant, accustomed to discipline, accustomed to humiliation. Or was I? When I had followed Lord Golden into Buckkeep, Verity's blade in its plain scabbard had hung at my side. Surely some would have marked that. My complexion and the scars on my hands marked me as a man who lived more out of doors than in. If I was to play this role, then it must be believable. It must be a role I could endure, as well as one I could act convincingly. At Lord Golden's door I knocked, paused discreetly to allow my master to expect me, then entered. The fool was at the casement looking out. I closed the door carefully behind me, latched it, and then set down the tray on the table. As I began to lay out the meal, I spoke to his back. "I am Tom Badgerlock, your servant. I was recommended to you as a fellow who was educated above his station by an indulgent master, but kept more for his blade than his manners. You chose me because you wanted a manservant capable of being your bodyguard as well as your valet. You have heard that I am moody and occasionally quick-tempered, but you are willing to try me to see if I will serve your purpose. I am 42 years old. The scars I bear I took defending my last master from an attack by six highwaymen. I killed them all. I am not a man to be provoked lightly. When my last master died, he left me a small bequest that enabled me to live simply. But now my son has come of age, and I wished to apprentice him in Buckkeep Town. You persuaded me to return to service as a way to defray my expenses." Lord Golden had turned from the window. His aristocratic hands clasped one another as he listened to my soliloquy. When I had finished, he nodded. "I like it, Tom Badgerlock. Such a coup for Lord Golden to have a manservant who is just a tiny bit dangerous to keep about. Such an air shall I put on over having hired such a man. You will do, Tom. You will do well." He advanced to the table, and I drew his chair out for him. He seated himself and looked over the setting and dishes I had prepared for him. "Excellent. This is exactly to my liking, Tom. Keep this up, and I shall have to raise your wages." He lifted his gaze to meet mine. "Sit down and eat with me," the fool suggested. I shook my head. "Best I practice my manners, sir. Tea?" For an instant the fool looked horrified. Then Lord Golden lifted a napkin and patted at his lips. "Please." I poured for him. "This son of yours, Tom, I have not met him. He's in Buckkeep Town, is he?"
"I told him to follow me here, sir." I suddenly realized I had told Hap little more than that. He would arrive with a weary old pony pulling a rickety cart with an aging wolf in it. I had not gone to Jinnah's niece to ask her to expect him. What if she took affront at my assumption that my boy could come there? Like a wave breaking over me, my other life caught up with me. I'd made no provisions for him. He knew no one else in Buckkeep Town save Starling, and I did not even know if she was currently in residence here. Besides, with relations strained between us, Hap was unlikely to turn to her for aid. Suddenly I knew I had to seek out the hedge witch and be sure my boy would be accepted there. I'd leave a message for Hap with her, and I had to approach Chade immediately about making provisions for him. Given what I knew now, it seemed a cold bargain, and my heart shrank within me at the thought of it. I could always borrow the money from the fool. I winced at the thought. "Just what are my wages?" I prompted myself to ask. But the words could not find their way to my tongue. Lord Golden pushed back from his table.
"You are quiet, Tom Badgerlock. When your son does arrive, I expect you to present him to me. For now, I think I shall let you have the first morning to yourself. Tidy up here, get to know the castle and the grounds.
He looked me over critically.
Fetch me paper, quill and ink. I will write you a letter of credit to Scrandon the tailor. I expect you will find his shop easily enough. You knew it of old. You need to be measured for more clothing, some for every day and some for when I want you to show well. If you are bodyguard as well as valet, then I think it fitting that you stand behind my chair at formal dinners and accompany me when I ride. And go also to Croy's. He has a weapon stall down near the Smithies Lane. Look through his used saws and find yourself a serviceable blade.
I nodded to each of his orders. I went to a small desk in the corner to set out pen and ink for my master. Behind me, the fool spoke quietly. Both Hod's work and Verity's blade are likely to be too well remembered here at Buckkeep Castle. I'd advise you to keep that blade in Chade's old tower room. I did not look at him as I replied.
I shall, and I shall also be speaking to the weapon master to ask him to provide me a practice partner. I shall tell him my skills are a bit rusty and you want me to sharpen them.
Who was Prince Dutiful's drill partner?
The fool knew. He always knew things like that. He spoke as he took his seat at the writing desk.
Cresswell was his instructor, but he paired him most often with a young woman named Delarie.
But you can't very well ask for her by name.
Tell him you'd like to work with someone who fights with two swords to sharpen your defense skills. I believe that is her speciality.
I shall. Thank you.
A few moments passed as his pen scratched busily across the paper. Once or twice he looked up, regarding me with a speculative look that made me uneasy. I wandered over to his window and looked out of it. It was a lovely day. I wished it belonged solely to me. I smelled melting wax and turned around to see Lord Golden applying his seal to his missives. He let the wax cool a bit, then held them out to me.
Off you go, to tailor and weapons dealer. As for me, I think I shall stroll for a bit in the gardens, and then I have been invited to the Queen's parlour for...
I saw her, Catricken.
I choked on a bitter laugh.
It seems so long ago. Us waking the stone dragons and all. And then something will happen, and it seems like yesterday.
The last time I saw Catricken, she sat astride Verity as dragon and bade us all farewell. Now, today, I saw her, and it suddenly all came real for me. She has reigned here as queen for well over a decade. I stepped aside from all this to heal, and because I thought I could no longer be part of it, now I've returned, and I look around me, and I think, I've missed my life. While I was off and alone, it went on here without me, and I'm forever doomed to be a stranger in my own home.
Regrets are useless, the fool replied. All you can do is start from where you are, and who knows, perhaps what you bring back from your self-imposed exile may prove to be just what is needed.
And time flies by us even as we speak.
Quite so,
Lord Golden replied. He gestured at his wardrobe.
My coat, Badgerlock, the green one.
I opened the wardrobe doors and extracted the required garment from its many brethren, then closed the panels as best I could upon the bulging excess. I held his coat for him, as so often I had seen Charim hold a coat for Verity, and assisted him into it. He held out his wrists to me, and I adjusted the cuffs and tugged the skirts of it straight. A flicker of amusement passed through his eyes.
Very good, Badgerlock, he murmured.
He preceded me to the door, and then waited while I opened it for him. Once he was gone, I latched it, and quickly finished the rest of the cooling breakfast. I stacked the dishes back on the tray. I looked at the entry to the fool's private room. Then I kindled a candle, entered my small chamber, and shut the door firmly behind me. But for the candle, the darkness would have been absolute. It took me a few moments to find the trigger that released the catch, and then two tries before I pressed the right spot on the wall. Despite the protest in my aching legs, I carried Verity's sword up the multitude of stairs to Chade's tower and leaned it in the corner by the mantel. Once I was back in the fool's room, I cleared the table. When I glanced into the looking-glass, the breakfast things in my hands, I saw a Buckkeep serving man. I gave a short sigh, reminded myself to keep my eyes lowered, and left the room.
Had I feared that on my return to Buckkeep Castle all would instantly recognize me? The reality was that no one even saw me. A glance at my servant's clothing and lowered eyes, and I was dismissed from the mind. I did receive sidelong looks from my fellow servants, but for the most part they were occupied with their own tasks. A few offered hasty greetings, and I accepted their welcome amiably. I would cultivate the servants, for little happens in any great house that the servants do not know about. I returned the dishes to the kitchen and left the castle. The guards passed me through with scarcely a word. I soon found myself on the steep roads that led down to the town. It was a fine day, and the road was well travelled. Summer seemed determined to linger a time yet. I fell in behind a group of ladies' maids going down to the town with baskets on their arms. They glanced warily back at me twice, and then ignored me. The rest of the way down the hill, I listened hungrily to their gossip, but found no hints there. They were speaking of the festivities that would accompany the prince's betrothal, and what their mistresses would wear. Somehow the queen and Shade had been able to disguise the prince's absence. In the town I went quickly about Lord Golden's errands, but kept my ears pricked for any word that might pertain to Dutiful. I found the tailor's shop with no difficulty. As the fool had told me, I knew it of old, when it was Molly's chandlery. It was strange to enter that place. The tailor took my letter of credit with no hesitation, but clucked over Golden's command for haste in their sewing. "Still, he has paid me well enough to make it worth my sleep tonight. Your clothes will be ready by tomorrow." I gathered from his other comments that Lord Golden had patronized him before. I stood silently on a low stool and was measured. No questions were asked of me, for Lord Golden had specified in his note how he wished his servant dressed. I was free to stand silent and wonder if I could still catch the scents of beeswax and aromatic herbs, or if I deceived myself. Before I departed, I asked the man if he knew of any hedge witches in Buckkeep. I wanted to ask one if my new position boded well for me. He shook his head at my low-born superstition, but told me to ask about near the Smithies Lane. This suited me well, for my next errand took me to Croy's. I wondered that the fool knew this man's shop at all, for it was a jackdaw's nest of battered weapons and armour, but again the proprietor took Lord Golden's note without question. I took my time, finding a blade I could live with. I wanted a simple, well-made weapon, but of course that is what any true man-at-arms chooses, so that was what Croy had least of. After trying to interest me in several remarkable swords that had elaborate guards and nondescript blades, he gave up on me and left me to sort through his collection. I did so, but kept up a constant stream of observations at how Buckkeep had changed since I was last there. It was not hard to get him gossiping, and then to turn his tongue to omens and portents, and those who dealt in them. I did not have to mention Jinnah by name to hear of her. At length, I selected a blade truly worthy of my rusty skills. Croy tutted over it. "Your master has gold and to spare, good man. Choose yourself something with a bit of sparkle on it, or some style to the basket." I shook my head. No, I want nothing that will catch in a man's clothes when the fighting is close and hot. This is the one I'll have. But I'll take a knife to go with it." This was soon found, and I left his shop. I walked through the loud clanging and gusting heat that marked the Smithies Lane. The hammers of competing smithies were a stunning counterpoint to the sun's beat. I had forgotten how constant the noise of a city was. I searched my memory as I walked, trying to recall if anything I had said to Jinnah would conflict with my newly modified life history. At length I decided it would have to do. If something did not make sense to her, well, she would just have to believe me a liar. I frowned at how much that disturbed me. Croy had described a dark green sign with a white hand painted on it. The lines on the hand were all done in red, quite skillfully. From the low eaves of her roof, several of her charms tinkled and turned in the sunlight. Luckily for me, none seemed to be against predators. It took me but a moment's pause to guess at their purpose. Welcome. They attracted me to the house and the door. It took a time for anyone to reply to my knock, but then the top half of the door opened, and Jinnah herself greeted me. "Badgerlock!" she exclaimed, peering at me, and it was pleasant that neither my warrior's tail nor my new clothes had kept her from knowing me. She swung the lower door open instantly. "Come in! Welcome to Buckkeep Town. Will you let me repay the debt of hospitality I owe you? Do come in. There is little in life so reassuring as a genuine welcome. She took my hand and drew me into the cool dimness of her home, as if I were an expected guest. The ceiling was low and the furnishings modest. There was a round table with several chairs about it. Nearby shelves held the tools of her trade, including an assortment of draped charms. Dishes and food were on the table. I had interrupted her meal. I halted, feeling awkward. I did not mean to intrude.
Not at all. Sit down and share.
She took a seat at the table as she spoke, and I could scarcely do otherwise.
Now, tell me, what brings you to Buckkeep?
She pushed the platter towards me. It held several jam tarts and smoked fish and cheese. I took a tart to give myself time to think. She must have noticed that I wore servant's garb, but left it to me to tell her what it meant. I liked that. I've taken a position at Buckkeep as a manservant to Lord Golden. Even knowing it was false, it was still hard to say those words. I had never realized what a proud fellow I was until I had to masquerade as the fool's servant. When I left home, I told Hap to join me when he could. At that time, I was not sure of my plans. I think that when he gets to Buckkeep Town, he may seek you out. May I leave word for him with you so you can send him on to me? I braced myself for all the inevitable questions. Why had I suddenly taken this employment? Why hadn't I simply brought Hap with me? How did I know Lord Golden? Instead, her eyes brightened, and she exclaimed, "With great pleasure. But what I propose is simpler. When Hap arrives, I'll keep him here, and send word up to the keep. There's a little room in the back he can use. It was my nephew's before he grew up and married away. Let the boy have a day or so in Buckkeep Town. He seemed to enjoy it so at Springfest, and your new duties will probably not allow you time to show him about yourself."
"I know he would love that," I found myself saying. It would be far easier for me to maintain my role as Lord Golden's servant if I did not have Hap in the midst of it. "My hope is that here in Buckkeep I'll be able to earn the coin to purchase him a good apprenticeship."
"Coming up?"
A large, ginger cat announced this to me at the same moment that he effortlessly elevated onto my lap. I stared at him in surprise. Never had an animal spoken so clearly to me via the wit save for my own bond animals. Nor had I ever been so completely ignored by an animal that had just spoken mind to mind with me. The cat stood, hind legs on my lap, front paws on the table, and surveyed the food. A plumy tail waved before my face.
"Fennel, shame on you! Stop that! Come here!"
Jinna leaned across the table to scoop the cat from my lap. She picked up the conversation as she did so.
"Yes, Hap's told me of his ambitions, and it's a fine thing to see a young man with hopes and dreams."
"He's a good boy," I agreed with her fervently, "and he deserves a good chance at making something of himself. I'd do anything for him."
Fennel now stood on Jinna's lap and stared at me across the table.
"She likes me better than you."
He stole a piece of fish from the edge of her plate.
"Do all cats speak so rudely to strangers?" I rebuked him.
He leaned back to bump his head possessively against Jinna's chest. His yellow-eyed stare was daunting.
"All cats talk however they want, to whomever they want. But only a rude human speaks out of turn. Be quiet, I told you. She likes me better than you."
He twisted his head to look up at Jinna's face.
"More fish."
"That's plain," she agreed. I tried to remember what I had said to her as I watched her give the cat a bit of fish at the edge of the table. I knew Jinna was not witted. I wondered if the cat was lying to me about all cats talking. I knew little of cats. Burrick had never kept them in the stables. We'd had rat dogs to keep the vermin down. Jinna misinterpreted my preoccupation. A touch of sympathy came into her eyes as she added,
"Still, it must be hard to leave your own home and being your own master to come to town and serve, no matter how fine a man Lord Golden may be. I hope he's as open-handed at paying you as he is when he comes down to Buckkeep Town to trade."
I forced a smile to my face. "You know of Lord Golden, then?" She bobbed a nod at me.
"By coincidence, he was right here in this very room just last month. He wanted a charm to keep moths from his wardrobe.
I told him I had never made such a thing before, but that I could attempt one. So gracious he was for such a noble man. And he paid me for it, just on my word, that I would make one. And then he insisted on looking at every charm I had in my shop, and bought no less than 6 of them. 6! One for sweet dreams, one for light spirits, another to attract birds. Oh, and he seemed quite entranced with that one, almost as if he were a bird himself. But when I asked to see his hands, to tune the charms to him, he told me that they were all intended as gifts. I told him that he might send each recipient to me to have the charms tuned if they wish, but as yet none of them have come. Still, they will work well enough as I built them. I do like to tune the charms, though. It's all the difference between a charm built by rote and one created by a master. And I do regard myself as a master, thank you very much. These last words she offered with a hint of laughter in her voice, in response to my raised brows. We laughed together, and I had no right to feel as comfortable with her as I did at that moment. "You've put my mind at rest," I declared. "I know Hap is a good lad, and little in need of my care any more. Yet I'm afraid I'm always imagining the worst befalling him."
"Don't ignore me,"
Fennel threatened. He hopped up onto the table. Jinnah put him on the floor. He floated back onto her lap. She petted him absently.
"That's just part of being a father," she assured me. "Or a friend."
A strange look came over her face.
"I'm not above foolish worries myself, even when they're none of my business."
She gave me a frankly speculative look that evaporated all the ease in my body.
"I'm going to speak plainly,"
she warned me. "Please," I invited her, but every bone in my body wished she would not.
"You're witted,"
she said. It was not an accusation. It was more as if she commented on a disfiguring disease.
"I travel quite a bit in my trade, more perhaps than you have in the last few years. The mood of the folk has changed towards witted ones, Tom. It's become ugly everywhere I've been recently. I didn't see it myself, but I heard that in a town in Farrow they display the dismembered bodies of the witted ones they've killed, with each piece in a separate cage to prevent them coming back to life."
I kept my face still, but I felt as if ice were creeping up my spine. Prince Dutiful. Stolen or run away, but in either case vulnerable. Outside the protective walls of Buckkeep, where people were capable of such monstrosities, a young prince was at risk.
"I'm a hedge witch,"
Jinnah said softly.
"I know what it is to be born with magic already inside you. It's not something you can change, even if you want to. More, I know what it's like to have a sister who was born empty of it. She seemed so free to me sometimes. She could look at a charm my father had made, and to her, it was just sticks and beads. It never whispered and nagged at her. The hours I spent beside my father, learning his skills, were hours she spent with my mother in the kitchen. When we were growing up, the envy went both ways, but we were a family, and we could be taught tolerance of our differences."
She smiled at her memories, then shook her head, and her face grew graver.
"Out in the wild world, it's different.
Folk may not threaten to tear me apart or burn me, but I've seen hatred and jealousy in more than one set of eyes. Folk think either that it isn't fair that I've got something they can ever have, or they fear that somehow I'll use what I've got to hurt them. They never stop to think they've got talents of their own that I'll never master. They might be rude to me, or jostle me on the street, or try to squeeze me out of my market space, but they won't kill me. You don't have that comfort. The smallest slip could be your death. And if someone provokes your temper, well, you've become a different man altogether. I confess it's been bothering me since the last time I saw you, so, well, to put my own mind at rest, I've made you something." I swallowed.
"Oh, thank you."
I could not even find the courage to ask what she had made me. Sweat was leaking down my spine, despite the coolness of the dim room. She had not intended to threaten me, but her words reminded me how vulnerable I was to her. My assassin's training went deep, I discovered.
"Kill her," suggested that part of me. "She knows your secret, and that makes her a threat. Kill her."
I folded my hands on the table before me.
"You must think me strange,"
she murmured as she rose and went to a cupboard. "To be interfering in your life so, when we have only met once or twice." I could tell she was embarrassed, yet determined to give me the gift she had made. "I think you are kind," I said awkwardly. Her rising had displaced Fennel. He sat on the floor, wrapped his tail around his feet, and glared up at me.
"There goes the lap. All your fault."
She had taken a box from the cupboard. She brought it back to the table and opened it. Inside was an arrangement of beads and rods on leather thongs. She lifted it and gave it a shake, and it became a necklace. I stared at it, but felt nothing. "What does it do?" I asked. She laughed lightly. "Very little, I'm afraid. I cannot make you seem unwitted, nor can I make you invulnerable to attack. I cannot even give you something that will help you master your temper. I tried to make something that would warn you of ill feelings towards you, but it became so bulky and large it was more like war harness than a charm. You will forgive my saying that my first impression of you was that you were a rather forbidding fellow. It took me a while to warm to you, and if Hap had not spoken so well of you, I would not have given you a moment of my time. I would have thought you a dangerous man. So did many appraise you as they passed us in the market that day, and so, bluntly, did you later show yourself to be. A dangerous man, but not a wicked one, if you will excuse my judging you. Yet the set of your face, by habit, shows folk that darker aspect of yourself. And now, with a blade at your hip and your hair in a warrior's tail, well, it does not give you a friendly demeanour. And it is easiest to hate a man that you first fear. So, this is a variation on a very old love charm. I have made it not to attract lovers, but to make people well-disposed towards you, if it works, as I hope it will. When you try to create a variation on a standard theme, it often lacks strength. Sit still now." She walked behind my chair with the dangling necklace. I watched her lower it past my face, and without being told, I bowed my head so she could fasten it at the nape of my neck. The charm made me feel no different, but her cool fingers against my skin sent a prickling chill over me. Her voice came from behind me. "I flatter myself that I got this fit right. It must not be too loose or it will dangle, nor so tight it chokes. Let me see it on you now. Turn around." I did as I was bid, twisting in my chair. She looked at the necklace, looked at my face, and then grinned broadly. "Oh, yes, that will do. Though you are taller than I recalled, I should have used a narrower bead for that. Well, it will do. I had thought it might take some adjusting, but I fear if I tinker with it, it will take it back to its origin. Now, wear it with your collar pulled up like so, so just a slice of it shows. There. If you were in a situation where you feel it might be useful, find an excuse to loosen your collar. Let it be seen, and folk will find you a more persuasive talker. Like so. Even your silences will seem charming." She looked down into my face as she tugged my collar more open about the charm. I looked up at her and felt a sudden blush heat my face. Our eyes locked.
"It works very well indeed,"
she observed, and unabashedly lowered her face to offer me her mouth. Not to kiss her was unthinkable. She pressed her mouth to mine. Her lips were warm. We sprang apart guiltily as the door handle rattled. The door scraped open and a woman's silhouette was outlined against the day's brightness. Then she came inside, pushing the door shut behind her.
"Phew! It's colder in there, thank Eda. Oh, beg pardon. Were you doing a reading?"
She had the same scattering of freckles on her nose and forearms. Clearly, this was Jinnah's niece. She looked about 20 or so and carried a basket full of fresh fish on her arm. Fennel ran to greet her, wrapping around her ankles.
"You love me best. You know you do. Pick me up."
"Not a reading, testing a charm. It seems to work." Jinnah's voice invited me to share her amusement. Her niece glanced from Jinnah to me, knowing she had been excluded from some joke, but taking it genially. She picked up Fennel, and he rubbed his face against her, marking his possession. "And I should be going, I'm afraid. I have several other errands to do before I'm required back at the keep.
I wasn't sure that I wanted to leave, but how interested I was in staying did not fit in at all with what I was supposed to be doing in Buckkeep. Most of all, I felt I needed a bit of time alone to decide what had just happened and what it meant to me.
"Must you go so right away?"
Jinnah's niece asked me. She seemed genuinely disappointed at seeing me rise from my chair.
"There's plenty of fish if you care to stay and eat with us."
Her impromptu invitation took me aback, as did the interest in her eyes.
"My fish. I'll eat it soon."
Fennel leaned down to look fondly at the food.
"The charm seems to work very well indeed,"
Jinnah observed in an aside. I found myself tugging at my collar. "I really must go, I'm afraid. I've work to do, and I'm expected back at the keep. But thank you for the invitation."
"Perhaps another time, then,"
the niece offered. And Jinnah added,
"Certainly another time, my dear. Before he leaves, let me introduce Tom Badgerlock. He has asked me to keep watch for his son, a young friend of mine named Hap. When Hap arrives, he may stay with us for a day or so. And Tom will certainly have supper with us then. Tom Badgerlock, my niece, Miskia."
"Miskia, a pleasure," I assured her. I lingered long enough to exchange parting pleasantries, and then hurried out into the sunlight and noise of the city. As I hastened back to Buckkeep, I watched the reactions of folk I met. It did seem that more smiled at me than usually did, but I realized that might simply be their reaction to my meeting their eyes. I usually looked aside from strangers on the street. A man unnoticed is a man unremembered, and that is the best that an assassin can hope for. Then I reminded myself that I was no longer an assassin. Nonetheless, I decided that I would remove the necklace as soon as I got home. I found that having strangers regarding me benevolently for no reason was more unnerving than having them distrust me on sight. I made my steep way up to the keep gate and was admitted by the guardsman there. The sun was high, and the sky blue and clear, and if any of the passing folk were aware that the sole heir to the Farseer crown had vanished, they showed no sign of it. They moved about their ordinary tasks, with no more than the concerns of a working day to vex them. By the stable several tall boys had converged on a plump young man. I knew him for a dullard by his flat face and small ears, and the way his tongue peeped out of his mouth. Dull fear showed in his small eyes, as the boys spread to encircle him. One of the older stable hands looked towards them, irritably. "No, no, no!" I turned, seeking the source of the floating thought. But of course, that availed me nothing. A faint snatch of music distracted me. A stable boy, sent hurrying about his tasks, jolted into me. Then, at my startled look, begged my pardon most abjectly, without thinking I had allowed my hand to ride my sword hilt. "No harm done," I assured him, and added, "Tell me, where would I find the weapons master this time of day?" The boy stopped suddenly, looked more closely at me, and smiled.
"Down at the practice courts, man. They're just past the new granary."
He pointed the way. I thanked him. And as I turned away, I tugged my collar closed.
Chapter 13 Bargains. Hunting cats are not entirely unknown within Buckduchy, but they have remained for years an anomaly. Not only is the terrain of Buck more suited to hound hunting, but also hounds are more suited to the larger game that is usually the prey of mounted hunters. A lively pack of hounds, boiling and baying, is a fine accompaniment for a royal hunt. The cat, when it is employed, is usually seen as more fittingly the dainty hunting companion of a lady, suitable for the taking of rabbits or birds. King Shrewd's first queen, Queen Constance, kept a little hunting cat, but more for pleasure and companionship than sport. Her name was Hispit. Sulinga's A History of Coursing Beasts. "The Queen wishes to see you." "When?" I asked, startled. It was hardly the greeting I had expected from Shade. I had opened the panel that admitted me to his tower to find him sitting in his chair before the hearth, waiting for me. He stood immediately. "Now, of course. She wants to know what progress we have made, and is naturally anxious to hear from you as soon as possible." "But I haven't made any progress," I protested. I had not even reported my day's work to Shade yet. I probably stank of sweat from the weapons court. "Then she'll want to hear that," he replied, relentlessly. "Come, follow me." He triggered the door and we left the tower chamber. It was evening. I had spent my afternoon doing as the fool had advised me, playing the role of a servant learning his way about a new place. As such, I'd talked to quite a number of my fellow servitors, introduced myself to Weapons Master Cresswell, and successfully arranged it that he would suggest I freshen my blade skills against Delarie. She proved to be a formidable swordswoman, nearly as tall as I was, and both energetic and light-footed. I was pleased she could not get past my guard, but I was soon panting with the effort of maintaining it. Trying to penetrate her defences was not yet an option for me. The weapons training Hod had enforced on me long ago stood me in good stead, but my body simply could not react as swiftly as my mind. Knowing what to do under an attack is not the same thing as being able to do it. Twice I begged leave for breathing space, and she granted it to me with the satisfaction of the insufferably young. Yet my leading questions about the prince availed me little. Until at my third rest interlude, I loosened my collar and opened my shirt wide to the cool air. I almost felt guilty doing it, yet I will not deny that I wanted to test if the charm would coax her to be more loquacious with me. It worked. Leaning on the wall in the shade of the weapons shed, I caught my breath and then looked up into her face. As our gaze met, her brown eyes widened in the way that a person's eyes widen at the sight of something pleasantly anticipated. Like a rapier rushing to its target, I thrust my question past her guard. "Tell me, do you press Prince Dutiful so hard when he practices with you?" She smiled. "No, I fear I do not, for I am usually more occupied with maintaining my own defences against him. He is a skilled swordsman, creative and unpredictable in his tactics. No sooner do I devise a new trick to use against him than he learns it and tries it against me. Then he loves his blade work as good fighters usually do." She paused. "No, I do not think that is it. He is a youth who makes no half measures in anything he does. He strives to be perfect in all he attempts." "Competitive, is he?" I tried to make my query casual. I busied my hands in smoothing my wayward hair back into its tail. Again she considered. "No, not in the usual sense. There are some I practice with who think only of beating their opponents. That preoccupation can be used against them. But I do not think the prince cares if he wins our matches, only that he fights each one perfectly. It is not the same thing as competing with my skills." Her voice trailed away as she pondered it. "He competes with himself, against an ideal he imagines." My prompting seemed to startle her for an instant. And then, grinning, "That is it, exactly. You've met him, then?" "Not yet," I assured her. "But I've heard a great deal about him and look forward to meeting him." "Oh, that won't be soon," she informed me, guilelessly. "He has his mother's mountain ways in some things. Often he goes apart from the whole court for a time to spend time just thinking. He isolates himself in a tower. Some say he fasts, but I have never seen signs of it when he returns to his routine." "So what does he do?" I asked in hearty puzzlement. "I've no idea." "You've never asked him?" She gave me an odd look, and when she spoke, her voice had cooled. "I am only his training partner, not his confidant. I am a guardsman, and he is a prince. I would not presume to question my prince on his private time alone. He is, as all know, a private person with a great need for solitude." Necklace or not, I knew I had pushed her too hard. I smiled, I hoped, disarmingly, and straightened up with a groan. "Well, as a training partner, you're the equal of any I've ever had. The prince is fortunate to have someone such as you to sharpen his skills against. As am I." "You're welcome, and I hope we can measure ourselves against one another again." I left it at that. I had as much success with the other servants. My queries, whether direct or indirect, yielded little information. It was not that the servants refused to gossip. They were as willing to chatter about Lord Golden or Lady Elegance as one could wish. But on the topic of the prince, they simply seemed to know nothing. The picture I formed of Dutiful was of a boy who was not disliked,
but was isolated not only by his rank but by his nature. It did not encourage me. I feared that if he had run, he had divulged his plans to no one. His solitary habits would have left him singularly vulnerable to kidnappers as well. My mind went back to the note the Queen had received. It had told her that the Prince was witted, and demanded she take suitable action. What had the writer intended as suitable action? Revealing his wit and proclaiming that the witted must be accepted? Or purifying the farseer line with his demise? Had the writer contacted the Prince as well? Chade's old workbench had yielded me the lockpicks I needed for my dinner hour adventure. The Prince had Prince Regal's former grand chambers. Batlock and I were old friends, and I anticipated that I could slip it easily. While the rest of the keep was at table, I approached the Prince's rooms. Here again I saw his mother's influence, for there was not only no guard at his door, but it was not locked. I slipped silently within, closing it softly behind me. Then I stared about me in perplexity. I had expected the same clutter and disorder that Hap tended to leave in his wake. Instead, the Prince's sparse possessions were all stored in such an orderly fashion that the spacious room looked nearly empty. Perhaps he had a fanatical valet, I mused. Then, recalling Catrican's upbringing, I wondered if the Prince had any body servants at all. Personal servants were not a mountain custom. It took me very little time to explore his rooms. I found a modest assortment of clothing in his chests. I could not determine if any were missing. His riding boots were still there, but Shade had already told me that the Prince's horse was still in his stall. He possessed a neat array of brush, comb, washbasin, and looking-glass, all precisely aligned in a row. In the room where he pursued his studies, the ink was tightly stoppered, and the tabletop had never suffered any blots or spills. No scrolls had been left out. His sword was on the wall, but there were empty pegs where other weapons might have hung. There were no personal papers, no ribbons or locks of hair tucked into the corner of his clothing chest, not even a sticky wine glass or an idly tossed shirt under his bed. In short, it did not strike me as a boy's bedchamber at all. There was a large cushion in a sturdy basket near the hearth. The hair that clung to it was short, yet fine. The stoutly woven basket bore the marks of errant claws. I did not need the wolf's nose to smell cat in the room. I lifted the cushion and found playthings beneath it, a rabbit skin tied to a length of heavy twine, and a canvas toy stuffed with catmint. I raised my eyebrows to that, wondering if hunting cats were affected by it as mousing cats were. The room yielded me little else. No hidden journal of princely thoughts, no defiant runaway's final note to his mother, nothing to suggest that the prince had been spirited away against his will. I had retreated quietly from his rooms, leaving all as I had found it. My route took me past the door of my old boyhood room. I paused, tempted. Who stayed there now? The hallway was empty and I yielded to the impulse. The lock on the door was the one I had devised, and it demanded my rusty skills to get past it. It was so stiff I was persuaded it had not turned in some time. I shut the door behind me and stood still, smelling dust. The tall window was shuttered, but the shutters were, as they had always been, a poor fit. Daylight leaked past them, and after a few moments my eyes adjusted to the dusky light. I looked around. There, my bedstead, with cobwebs embroidering the familiar hangings. The cedar clothing chest at the foot of it was thick with dust. The half-empty, black and cold, and above it, the faded tapestry of King Wisdom treating with the elderlings. I stared at it. As a boy of 9, it had given me nightmares. Time had not changed my opinion of the oddly elongated forms. The golden elderlings stared down on the lifeless and empty room. I suddenly felt as if I had disturbed a grave. As silently as I had entered the chamber, I left it, locking the door behind me. I had thought to find Lord Golden in his chambers, but he was not there. "Lord Golden?" I asked questioningly, and then advanced to tap lightly at the door of his private chamber. I swear I did not touch the catch, but it swung open at my touch. Light flooded out. The small chamber had a window, and the afternoon sun filled it with gold. It was a pleasant, open room that smelled of wood shavings and paint. In the corner, a plant in a tub climbed a trellis. Hanging on the walls, I recognized charms such as Jinnah made. On the work table in the middle of the room, amongst the scattered tools and paint pots, There were pieces of rod, string, and beads, as if he had disassembled a charm. I found I had taken a step into the room. There was a scroll, weighted flat on the table, with several charms drawn on it. They were unlike anything I had seen in Jinnah's shop. Even at a glance, the sketches were oddly unsettling. I remember that, I thought, and then, when I looked closer, I was absolutely certain I had never seen the light before. A shiver ran down my back. The little beads had faces, the rods were carved with spinning spirals. The longer I stared, the more they disturbed me. I felt as if I could not quite get my breath, as if they were pulling me into them. "Come away," the fool spoke softly from behind me. I could not reply. I felt his hand on my shoulder, and it broke the spell. I turned at his touch. "I'm sorry," I said instantly. "The door was ajar, and I did not expect you back so soon, or it would have been latched." That was all he said. And then he drew me from the room and shut the door firmly behind us. I felt as if he had pulled me back from a precipice. I drew a shaky breath. What were those? "An experiment. What you told me of Jinnah's charms made me curious, so when I reached Buckkeep Town, I resolved to see them for myself. Once I had, I wanted to know how they worked. I wanted to know if the charm could only be made by a hedge witch, or if the magic was in the way they were assembled. And I wanted to know if I could make them work better." His voice was neutral. "How can you stand to be around them?" I demanded. Even now, the hair on the back of my neck was standing. "They are tuned to humans. You forget that I am a wight." The statement left me as speechless as the insidious little sketches had. I looked at the fool, and for one blink I could see him as if for the first time. As attractive as his colouring was, I had never seen any other person with it. There were other differences, the way his wrists attached his hands to his arms, the airiness of his hair. But when our eyes met, I was looking at my old friend again. It was like jolting back to the earth after a fall. I suddenly recalled what I had done. "I'm sorry, I didn't intend to. I know you need your privacy." I felt shamed, and hot blood rushed to my face. He was silent for a moment. But then he said justly, "When I came to your home, you hid nothing from me." I sensed that the statement reflected his idea of what was fair rather than his emotions on the topic. "I won't go in there again," I promised fervently. That brought a small smile to his face. "I doubted that you would." I suddenly wanted to change the subject, but the only thought that came to me was, "I saw Jinnah today. She made this for me." I opened the collar of my shirt. He stared, first at the charm, then up at my face. He seemed dumbstruck. Then a wide and fatuous grin spread over his face. "It's supposed to make people feel kindly towards me," I explained. "To counteract my grim appearance, I think, though she was not so unkind as to say that directly." He took a breath. "Cover it," he begged, laughing. And as I did so, he turned away from it. He walked almost hastily to the chamber window and looked out. "They are not tuned to my bloodlines, but that does not mean I am completely impervious against them. You often remind me that in some ways I am still very human." I unfastened it from my throat and held it out to him. "You can take it and study it if you like. I'm not entirely sure I like wearing it. I think I'd rather know what people honestly think of me." "Somehow I doubt that," he muttered. But he returned to take the charm from my hand. He held it out in the air between us, studied it, and then glanced at me. "Tuned to you," he guessed. I nodded. "Intriguing. I would like to keep it for a day or so. I promise not to take it apart. But after that, I think you should wear it." "Always." "I'll think about it," I promised, but felt no inclination to don it again. "Shade wanted to see you as soon as you came in," he suddenly said, as if he had only then remembered it. And there we had left it. And I felt that I was, if not excused, at least forgiven for going where I had no business being. Now, as I followed Shade through the narrow passageway, I asked him, "How was this all built? How can a labyrinth like this that winds all through the castle be kept secret?" He carried a candle and walked before me. He spoke over his shoulder softly. "Some was built into the bones of the keep. Our ancestors were never trusting folk. Part of it was intended as a system of bolt holes. Some of it has always been used for spying. Some of it used to be servant stairs, incorporated into the secret passages during a phase of intense reconstruction following a fire. And some was created deliberately, in your lifetime. When you were small, do you remember when Shrewd ordered that the hearth in the guard room be rebuilt? Vaguely.